It is September the 6th, and we are in Parshas Miketz. We are on page Sugazot. We are on page. We're actually between 224 and 226. We left off last time with two points that we were going to cover tonight and then go further. We read last time how Paro told his dreams over to Yosef. And then Yosef explained the dreams to Paro on page really. Let's start with it's really 226. We read how then Yosef explained what Paro's dreams meant. So Yosef told Paro, as we know, that there's going to be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine, and we know that Yosef told Paro that the reason why there were two dreams is because it's going to happen immediately, that there's not going to be any delays happening right away. We pointed out that when Yosef tells Paro about his dreams and insists that Hashem is the one who is telling Paro about them, he uses two different words in expressing himself. In Pasuk Chaf, Hey, 25, right at the top of the page. It says, Vayomer Yosef el Paro. Yosef said to Paro, Chalom Paro echad hu. The dream of Paro is really one dream. Es asher ha'elokim oseh higid l'faro. That which Hashem is doing, he has told to Paro. So the word he's using there is oseh, that Hashem is doing. Later on, after he tells them what the dream means, in Pasuk Chaf Ches in 28, it says, "Hu hadavar asher dibarti al Paro." This is the thing that I have said to Paro. Asher ho Elokim oseh. I emphasized the wrong word before. Hera es Paro. He has shown Paro. Let's look back at Chaf Hey again at 25. It says, "Es asher ho Elokim oseh he gid lefaro." That was which Hashem is doing. He has told to Paro. That's the emphasis that he has told to Paro what he's going to do. While in Chaf Ches 28, it says almost the same thing. Asher ha'elokim oseh, that which Hashem is doing, hera es paro, he has shown paro. So why the change from higid, he has told to paro, to hera, he has shown paro? And the Mefarshim discussed this, Rashi points it out. And the difference is, which part of the interpretation is Yosef referring to? When Yosef first says what Hashem is doing, he has told Paro. The very next pasuk, which is Chavav 26, there Yosef tells Paro about the years of plenty. Sheva paros hatovos sheva shonim heina. The seven good cows are seven years. V'sheva hashibolim hatovos, and the seven good sheaves sheva shonim heina are 7 years. Chalom echad hu, it is all one dream. So there, when Yosef is discussing the good years, the years of plenty, he refers to it as higid, as told over. Later, when he gets to the years of famine, which is Pasuk Chav Zayin 27, he then says, V'sheva ha'paros ha'rekos v'ha'ra'os ha'olos ha'charehen, and the seven empty and bad cows that came up after them, sheva shanim heimna, are 7 years. V'sheva ha'shibolim ha'rekos, and the seven empty sheaves, shidufos ha'karim, that have been scorched by the east wind, yiyu sheva shnei shanim, they will be seven, sheva shnei ra'av, they will be 7 years of famine. And immediately following mentioning the 7 years of famine, that's where Yosef says, "Hu adavar asher dibarti al Paro." That's what I've spoken to Paro. Asher ho Elokim oseh hera es Paro. That which Hashem is doing, He has shown to Paro. So, when referring to the years of plenty, he uses the word higid. He has told over. And when referring to the years of famine, he says hera. He has shown. The question is, so why should that create a difference? So Rashi explains that because the years of plenty were happening right away, they were immediate, therefore you can use the word higid to tell something over. From the word hagadah, like we have on Pesach. magid. You can tell something over that is right in front of you, that is immediate. That which is in the future hasn't happened yet. It's in the distance. You would not use the word higid to tell over. You would rather use the word herah to show. To show, to look at, is something which is a distance away. So the 7 years of famine, which were 7 years away, they weren't going to happen for another 7 years, there it would be inappropriate to use the word higid. Rather, the word herah is appropriate. That's what Rashi says. What does he mean to say? Well, you can look at something that's in the distance. You can show somebody something that's in the distance. You can see something that's far away. It may not be right in front of you. You can still see it off in the distance. Lehagid, to tell over, means to tell it over in a way that is immediate, that is right there. These words, and the observation Rashi is making, indicate to us a significant difference between the Yamim Tovim of Pesach and of Chanukah. On Pesach, the whole point of Pesach, of the night of Pesach, is Haggadah, to tell over, Magid. That's what it's about. On Pesach, you're supposed to sit at the Seder, and you are supposed to live at the Seder as if you actually went out of Egypt. We're supposed to give over to our children the sense of leaving Egypt as if we ourselves had done it. It's not meant to be a re'iyah, something that is off in the distance. It's not meant to be something that we tell our children about that happened many years ago and that is that isn't real. We are to tell it over in a way that is magid, that is in front of us, that is immediate, that is here. That's the way it's supposed to be told over. That's why the Seder involves so much acting. That's why the Seder involves a description of the Makos and a description of how you talk to each child. And everything, we lean, we drink the wine, we eat the maror, we're actually enacting, we're going through the motions of the slavery and the redemption. That's a Haggadah. If we would simply tell over facts, many years ago, we were in slavery, we got out, that wouldn't be a Haggadah. That would be a Re'iyah, to show. On Chanukah, we're also celebrating a redemption of sorts, that we were saved from the Misyavnim. And we don't enact it. We don't do anything other than lighting the candles, which is to remind ourselves of the Nes. But we don't act it out. We don't pick up a sword and a shield and etc. We don't do those things. There's no mitzvah to do those things. Now, it's true that we do things as a minhag. So as a minhag, we play dreidel. As a minhag, we eat latkes, which have oil. And there's a minhag to eat milchiks, because that's how Yehudis killed the head of the Yevonim. So we do. There are minhagim. There are customs. But there is no mitzvah to do these things. Because there, it is re'iyah. The way that one really, if you want to say, gets into Chanukah, many of the Mefarshim say is that you look at the lights. You look. You're roe es haneros. If someone is not able to light menorah for whatever reason, and they're traveling outside and they see a menorah in somebody else's window, they can make a bracha of Sha'asa Nisim Lavo Senu Bayami Mahim Bazman Hazeh. You can make that bracha that commemorates the miracle by seeing somebody else's candles. Seeing the Neros is what Chanukah is about, because Chanukah is more distant. We're not reliving it, we're commemorating it. It's a different type of holiday than Pesach. One can ask the question, why is it that when Chazal instituted the Yontif of Chanukah, they did not make it a Haggadah? why did they maintain it as a only a re'iyah, which is more distant, rather than a hagara, which is a good question, and we can discuss at Hanukkah time, perhaps. I have given a shir on this in the past. But right now we're just going to observe the difference between the two based on the point that Rashi is making over here, that Haggadah is immediate, Re'iyah is distant.
Why do you pick Hanukkah, like, based off of Hanukkah? Why didn't you say, how did you get Hanukkah to compare those?
Because I couldn't find another Re'iyah.
Well,
yeah, because there, it's the whole point is looking at the Neros. No, that's all. Because you look at the Neros.
Oh, but there's not, that word is not used
when? Well, the Mefarshim say that a person should be Roe es Haneros. That's what it says to the Vivos. To look at. Because there is nothing else you do with Hanukkah other than look at the Neros. That's what you're doing when you light them. The whole point is people should see the Neros. That's what it's about. With Pesach, we don't put something in the window for people to see. There's no inyan on Pesach to put something so that people who pass by will see in the window what's going on. With Pesach, we're enacting, we're reliving what happened. It's a different way of observing it. So that's based on these Rashi's over here of Haggadah and Re'iyah. We lay in Parshas Miketz, which is what we're doing right now. Parshas Miketz is always read Hanukkah time. So when I was in my Rebbe's Shir of Tzvi Berkowitz, as a bacher in Baltimore, we had a Hanukkah Masiba at his house, and he asked me to say a Dvar Torah at the Hanukkah Masiba, and I said this. And he gave me a Yashar Koyach. So I was very proud of myself at the time, and that's why I say this over, because at the time he acknowledged it.
You're reliving.
That's right, I'm reliving. That's right. Okay, so that's the difference between the two things. So that Rashi does not associate, see, one would have thought without Rashi that perhaps Haggadah would be associated with the good years and Re'iyah with the bad years. That's what I would have said without Rashi. I would have tried to think of a way of tying in Haggadah with good and Re'iyah with bad. But that's not what Rashi does. Rashi instead ties it in with whether it's immediate or distant. The other thing we said we would do is talk about the amount of times, Herman brought this up last week, the amount of times, I believe it was Herman who brought it up, the amount of times that the number 7 is used over here with all these years. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing that the story here is told over 3 times. First we are told Paro dreamed, and we're told what the dreams are. Then we are told that Paro said over his dreams to Yosef. And we pointed out last week that rather than just tell us, and Paro told his dreams to Yosef, Vayaged Paro es chalamosav le Yosef, rather than just doing that, instead, the Torah tells us word for word what Paro said to Yosef and said over the whole dreams a second time, which we knew that already. There's no need for us to hear it again, it would seem. And then, when Yosef is interpreting the dreams to Paro, he repeats the dreams, so that we end up hearing them 3 times. The Medrash tells us that in reality, let's add it up before I tell you what the Medrash says. Let's start on page 222. Let's count how many bad years are actually mentioned. You have on page 222 in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. V'hinei sheva paros acheros alos acharean min hayor. 7 evil cows came up after them from the river. Ra'os marevedakos basar. They didn't look nice. So there's your first 7 bad cows.
But there's the 7 good ones are in verse 2.
Correct. Then, in Pasuk Vav, in verse 6, V'hinei sheva shibolim dakos ushtupos kadim tzomchos acharean. The 7 scrawny sheaves of wheat came up next. So you have the second 7. So far, so good. Then we move to page 224. And we have the same thing again in Psukim Yud Ches 18 through 2:24, Paro tells it all over again to Yosef. Then, when we're up to on page 226, you have it again. You have Pasuk Chavav 26. Sheva paros atavos sheva shanim heina v'sheva shlim atavos sheva shanim heina. Each one of the good ones are 7 years. And then 27 chavzayin v'sheva paros harakos v'haraos halos achareyan sheva shanim heina. That's 7 years. V'sheva shibolim harikos shivos akadim. You sheva shnei ra'av. The seven sheaves will be 7 years of famine. So everything is said over to us 3 times. What Linda's pointing out is that both the good and the bad are said over 3 times, which is important to know. The Medrash, though, focuses on the 7 bad years and says that in reality, if the wheat and the cows were each said over 3 times, so we have a total of 6 times that there's a reference to the bad or evil years. 6 times 7 is 42. Therefore, says the Medrash, really there were supposed to be 42 years of famine in Egypt. In fact, says the Das HaKeneni Bali HaTosos, that when Yosef says to Paro, in Pasuk Chav Zayin in 27, at the very end of the Pasuk, he says, Yiyu Sheva Shnei Ra'av, they will be 7 years of famine, that Yihiyu, they will be, was actually a prayer on Yosef's part. Yosef was davening that the famine should only last 7 years rather than 42 years. Mm-hmm. He was not stating a fact. He was praying to limit the famine to only 7 years and not 42 years. And he was successful. It did become limited to only 7 years rather than 42 years. But then, in reality, what happened? Okay, in reality, it was only 2 years, because what happens is we first have the 7 years of plenty. Then after 2 years of plenty, after 2 years of famine, Yaakov and his sons are out of food, and you have the whole incident with sending the brothers down, and they go back and forth, bring Binyamin, etc., etc. Finally, Yosef reveals himself, and then Yaakov comes down to Mitzrayim after only 2 years of famine. The Torah tells us that when Yaakov came down to Mitzrayim, the famine stopped. And the famine only lasted 2 years.
So that was in the merit of Yaakov?
It was in the merit of Yaakov. Now we'll see later that rather than that being a cause for the Egyptians to say that Yosef was obviously wrong, Yosef said 7 years. But it was only 2 years. You see Yosef's a liar. You see Yosef's wrong. It was very obvious that it was because of Yaakov. And we'll see later, wherever Yaakov went, things started to grow again. It was clear and obvious that Yaakov was the cause for the end of the famine. Be that as it may, it was downgraded first from 42 years to 7 years, and then from 7 years to 2 years. The Medrash tells us that there were still meant to be 42 full years of famine in Egypt, not just 2 years of famine.
So 40 more years.
And the 40 years were kept on account. And later on, which we learned in the Yechezkel class, it's also mentioned in Sefer Yirmiyah, later on, Mitzrayim would be desolate for 40 years. After the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, the Egyptians also were exiled by Nebuchadnezzar. He came and destroyed Egypt and took the people into exile. When that happened, Egypt remained desolate for 40 years. That was the rest of the 42 years that were meant to have happened now. That were downgraded first by Yosef and then by Yaakov. That's how the Medrash explains what happened over here.
What is the symbolism of 40 years? Is it something about 40 years? Like 40 years in the desert?
40 is always considered to be the creation of a new life. Because the Gemara says that it's 40 days before the fetus is formed inside the mother. And that's why it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, because they had to change the nature of the world. Yeah. Same thing over there.
Because it's the new luchos?
Right. Right. The first time also with the luchos was 40 days. Mm-hmm. Anytime you have a birth or a rebirth, it's a 40. Yeah.
And what gave Yaakov the right? I mean, why did Hashem give him that for 42 years?
Okay. So that's the question over here. With Yaakov, he didn't do it on purpose. It happened on its own. Hashem did it through Yaakov. So when Yaakov came down, that would be why did Hashem want it to end early. Yeah.
Like if Hashem wanted 42 years,
okay.
What do you do? Change his mind?
So that we can talk about later, why is it that when Yaakov came, the famine ended? Which is a good question. But here, why would Yosef daven that the famine be downgraded to only 7 years?
And why would Hashem listen? He wouldn't have been able to do it for 42 years.
How do you know?
I don't know.
How could food stay for
7 years?
That too. How could it stay for
two? Yosef. Okay, so we have to understand what is going on over here. What is the purpose of this famine? This is a very strange thing. Hashem has made a famine. But he makes a famine that's preceded by 7 years of plenty. And not only that, he tips off the entire country of Egypt through Yosef, mm-hmm. that this is going to happen.
Yeah.
He didn't have to tip them off. He could have just brought the 7 years of plenty and then had the years of famine. Or, don't bring the 7 years of plenty and have the years of famine. It amounts to the same thing, because if you think about it, if you have 7 years of plenty and don't save for the 7 years of famine, then you may as well not have the 7 years of plenty. You're going to walk into the 7 years of famine without anything to eat. So, what's the point in doing this? Why is it done? So what did you say?
To bring the brothers down.
Okay, to bring the brothers down, but it's beyond that. You're right. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. Okay, it does show this chosavas. It shows the merit of the patriarchs. What else?
Okay.
We've talked about this before, that in the beginning of Megillas Rus, Megillas Rus begins with a famine. Vayhi b'mei shvot hashoftim, it was in the days that the judges judged. Vayhi ra'av ba'aretz, there was a famine in the land. Right there in the beginning, the Targum says that there were 10 famines that were decreed in the world from the beginning of creation until Mashiach comes. The first one was in the days of Adam HaRishon, the second one was in the days of Enosh, the third one was in the days of, I believe, of Abraham, then one in the days of Yitzchak, one in the days of Yaakov, and it goes on and on. One of them was over there in Rus. And the last one is in our days. The Medrash says, Lo ra'av la'lechem v'lo tzama la'mayim, as the Pasuk says, it's not a famine of food and not a drought for water. Rather, it's a famine and a drought in hearing the word of Hashem. We don't have any Nevi'im, we don't have any prophets, we don't hear the word of Hashem. That's the 10th famine. The question on this medrash is, what do you mean there are 10 famines? There are only 10 famines? And we can probably think of 10 famines that happen in our day, if you go throughout the globe and think of different places where they are scarce, they're scarce on food. Yeah.
What do you mean we don't hear the words of Hashem? You mean the people aren't, Jewish people that aren't observant?
All of us, there's a dearth. It's hard, it's very difficult to find the word of Hashem.
Huh?
No prophet.
It's very difficult.
No, I understand that, but still, we come to classes, there are young people going to schools, there are rabbin and
even
writing books, there's
right.
the art scroll, there's a lot going on.
There is
what does that mean?
Because it means that we're only getting the tip of it. There's so little that we're getting. There's so much depth in Torah,
right.
and we're picking up so little of it. Right. Even our greatest sages, right. they pale in comparison to the generations before. And certainly all of us. What are we getting already? So yes, we are learning. And we do get credit for that. But the amount that we know is so little compared to those our predecessors, those who came before us.
You mean like the time of Chizkiyahu?
Or even just go back
on the street.
Go back to European Jewry. They knew much more than we know today. And go back even 50 years ago. I mean, they did, you know, the previous generations knew a lot more than we do.
Why is it then that if we know so little, why is it that Mashiach is going to come in these days rather than those days?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question.
Right.
Because Hashem only expects us to do what we can with what we're able. Hashem doesn't expect us to do better than we can.
So didn't they do the best they could?
Apparently not. But we're not doing the best we can either, because Mashiach hasn't come yet. That's the proof. When Mashiach comes, we'll know that we're doing the best we can. So, but the question is, what do you mean 10 famines? There are far more than 10 famines, hundreds, thousands of famines since the creation of the world.
10 famines.
Okay, that's true, and I would say it a little more sharply than that. 10 famines that have a specific purpose in Hashem's ultimate plan. Now, that doesn't mean to say that other famines don't have a purpose. They all have purposes, but there are 10 that we would call our center stage. For instance, the famine in the days of Rus, the purpose of that famine was to bring Rus to Eretz Yisrael so she would marry Boaz, which would bring about David HaMelech. That was the purpose of the famine. The famine was to bring about Malchus Beis David, the royal family. The famine in the days of now, the purpose of the famine, I don't know if we're in it or not, but we're close to it if we're not in it. The purpose of the famine is to bring about Mashiach. That's the purpose of the famine. Whatever that means. It seems, like you said before, counterintuitive. That why would it bring Mashiach if we don't know Torah? But that's the purpose of the famine, is to bring about Mashiach. Each one of these famines has a specific purpose, and it's playing center stage in the development of Hashem's plan in the world. This famine, the purpose of it was to bring about the Shibud Mitzrayim, to bring about the slavery in Egypt, which would be followed by the Geula, the redemption, which ultimately is how Hashem took us as His people. This is the purpose of this famine. Yes, it's to bring the brothers and Yaakov down to Egypt, but beyond that, to bring us, to put us in Egypt in a way that we are stuck there, ultimately become slaves, and only get out through Moshe and the Ten Makos. That's the purpose of this famine. That means that in order for this famine to be successful, it can't just kill everybody and starve everybody. More than that, the famine has to happen in a way that it will make the brothers and Yaakov change their location. Now, how would they change their location based on a famine? If there's a famine across the land, both in Eretz Canaan and Eretz Mitzrayim, why should they go from Canaan to Mitzrayim? There's a famine in all places. What's the point in moving? Unless in Mitzrayim, despite the famine, there's food. While in Canaan, there is no food. That will cause a migration. And that was the goal. It will cause them to move. But it goes beyond that. It goes way beyond that. In order for us to be slaves in Egypt, and in order for the story of our slavery and ultimate redemption to be as dramatic as Hashem wanted it to be, Mitzrayim had to be the most powerful nation in the world. Economically, militarily, they had to be the most powerful nation. Because what's going to happen is that Mitzrayim is going to be so powerful that no one escapes from Mitzrayim. It never happens. And then, incredibly, Hashem is going to take out millions of people in one fell swoop and utterly destroy the Egyptian power. That's what's going to happen. As Hashem says to us, that the reason why Hashem gives the Egyptians the Eser Makos is that we should tell over to our children, Eis Asher Hisalalti B'Mitzrayim, Hashem says, the way I toyed with the Egyptians, they were like toys in my hands. I was able to manipulate them and do whatever I wanted to the most powerful people on the face of the earth. This famine had the dual purpose, which is really one purpose, but it happens all at once, is to bring us down there and to catapult the Egyptians into world prominence beyond whatever the world had known until then. Incredible power, incredible wealth, incredible military power. That's what had to happen over here. This happens, it can only happen, if somehow Egypt gets a commodity that everybody needs and no one else has. Now that's hard to do. How do you make it that one country has a commodity that everybody needs and no one else has? Well, we see it in our day today. Saudi Arabia has a commodity that everybody needs and not no one else has, but it's very hard to get. That catapults Saudi Arabia to becoming a very wealthy nation. Of course, Saudi Arabia... What's that?
Are they related to Mitzrayim?
Oh, they're in the Middle East, I don't know. But Saudi Arabia is lacking other things. Right? They don't have a lot of food over there. They need to buy things. It's not a self-sufficient nation. So yes, it gives them great wealth and great strength and power, but not to the exclusion of everybody else. It just balances the scales a little bit. Whereas it used to be that the Middle East were just nomads and the Western powers were able to completely control the Middle East. That is no longer the case. But what Hashem wanted to do was make Egypt all powerful, where they were needed by everyone and they didn't need anyone. That can only happen when the item that you have that everybody else needs is not something like oil, which is, after all, a luxury. In the end, it's a luxury. Even though we run on oil, we need oil today, but that's because of the way we choose to live. But ultimately, it's a luxury. If we didn't have oil, we would still survive. But food, if people don't have food, they die. And everybody needs food. And so Hashem made it that Egypt is the only place in the known world, at least in the world that mattered, that had food. Which makes Egypt, hands down, the most powerful nation around. No one's even close. Everybody needs Egypt. Egypt needs no one. That's what happens through this famine. The only way that can happen is if it's first preceded by years of plenty, and the Egyptians are tipped off to it so that they can save up and become the only powerful nation. That's what happens. Now, it could have happened that Hashem simply would not have brought a famine against Egypt and only brought a famine against all the surrounding lands. That's what could have happened. There are two problems with doing it that way. Number one, it would not have made Yosef rise to prominence. It would have nothing to do with Yosef. It would just be that all of a sudden, everybody else is starving, and Egypt is growing food. So, that would have nothing to do with Yosef. It would have nothing to do with the brothers. It would have nothing to do with Yaakov. And that would not put Yosef front and center in Egyptian life. That's number one. Number two, that would make Egypt appear as if it is the promised land. If Egypt all of a sudden has all the food and all the surrounding countries have nothing, and Egypt is growing food, that makes Egypt look like it's a better land than any other land. This way, all the lands have a famine. Just Egypt had this person, Yosef, who warned them to save up. And that makes Egypt grow in prominence and greatness. That's what happens through this famine.
So it's like Hashem purposely made Egypt powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So he could show his power by destroying them.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. Exactly right. When Paro has these dreams, as we pointed out, Paro understood intuitively that these dreams were important. He knew from the way that he dreamt the dreams, whether it's the fact that he was standing on the river and they worshipped the river, whether it's because he just saw how vividly the dreams appeared, he knew these dreams were of vital importance, nationally and perhaps internationally. He knew that. We pointed out 2 weeks ago that that's why Paro could not accept the interpretation of his sorcerers. Their interpretation was, you're going to have seven daughters and you're going to bury seven daughters. That was their interpretation. Paro couldn't accept that interpretation because it didn't mean anything. So what? What's the point in my knowing that? How will that affect the national life in Egypt or the international life of the world? It doesn't do anything for us. It doesn't matter. When Yosef interpreted the dreams, then the dreams mattered. There was an importance to them that affected national life. It was much more acceptable to Paro. But it was only acceptable to Paro when Paro could see how these dreams would affect national life. That's why Yosef, as we pointed out last time, offers unsolicited advice. And this was the other point we were going to cover tonight. Yosef doesn't just interpret the dreams. Yosef goes on to advise Paro what to do about the dreams. This was presumptuous. This was very presumptuous. Yosef is some nobody in jail. He's an Eved, he's a slave, he's an Ivri, he's a foreigner, he's a Nar, he's a kid, even though he wasn't that young, he was 30 years old, but he wasn't...
But he had been, you know, Potiphar's right-hand man.
Okay.
I'm sure Paro knew who he was.
I'm not so sure Paro knew who he was. I don't know.
He had been with Potiphar.
It could be he had heard his name before.
He had status. I mean,
it could be.
He was a nobody.
It could be he had heard his name before, but he certainly didn't know him as a great advisor or anything like that. And Yosef was asked by the king, interpret my dreams. Yosef does so. And then Yosef goes on to offer unsolicited advice. That's a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah.
Who asked you? Right? The king has a lot of advisors. Thank you for the information. Go home. I didn't ask you for advice. That's what Paro could have said to him. Right? But Yosef takes the initiative and he tells Paro about it. Paro doesn't get upset. Paro is impressed. Because what Yosef has done is not just advise Paro how to handle the dreams, which would have been just unsolicited advice. Yosef has informed Paro why the dreams are being told to him and why all this is happening. Yosef tells Paro, when he tells him, save up the food, we're going to read it right now, and it'll be available for the years of famine. Paro's no fool. Paro figures it out, that what Yosef is doing is setting up Egypt to become incredibly powerful. Let's read it inside. Starting with Pasuk, Lamed Gimel 33. Ve'ata yereh Paro ish navon v'chacham. And now Paro should appoint. Really, yereh means to see. Okay, seek out. A man who is both... Now, navon and chacham, they say discerning and wise. We'll discuss that in a moment. The difference between bina and chachma. Navon and chacham. V'shisehu al eretz Mitzrayim. And he should set him up over the land of Egypt. Put him in control. Ya'aseh Paro v'yafkeh pekidim al ha'aretz. Paro should do and put overseers on the land. V'chimesh ha'aretz Mitzrayim. And he should prepare the land of Egypt. B'shem ha'shnei ha'asavah in the 7 years of plenty. V'yikbitzu es kol ochel ha'shanim ha'tavos. They should gather all the food of the good years. Ha'ba'os ha'ila that are coming. V'yitzberu var. And they should pile a pile. How do they say it here? A mass grain, tachas yad Paro, under the control of Paro, ochel be'arim, food in the cities, v'shamaru, and they should be guarded under lock and key. V'haya ochel l'pikadon l'aretz, and the food should be as a how do they have it here, as
reserve,
okay, for the land. L'shem ha'shnei ha'ra'av, for the 7 years of famine, asher tiyena be'aretz Mitzrayim, that will come in the land of Mitzrayim, v'lo sikareis ha'aretz ba'ra'av, and the land will not be cut off, will not be destroyed during the famine. And then it says, v'yitav ha'davar b'enei Paro, that thing was good in the eyes of Paro, u'v'enei chol avadav, and in the eyes of all of his servants. So this was very impressive to Paro, that Yosef not only interpreted, but then showed him what would why this was being told to him. In other words, it's part of the interpretation. There is no point in having the dreams and having them interpreted if they're not going to affect national life. Yosef shows Paro how they will affect national life. Yes?
Really, Yosef created this great power. He created national life.
Because Yosef understands this is why Hashem is doing this. Yosef has the same questions we have. Why do this? Why bring 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine? Why tell Paro about the 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine? Just bring 7 years of famine. If you want to bring a famine, bring a famine. What's the point? Yosef understands the point is that Paro should save the food and become powerful. Yosef sees it to the end. Yosef also understood, seeing it to the end, that the purpose was to bring his family down. He has it all figured out. Yosef is extremely intuitive, as we know.
He knows at that point.
He's got it all figured out. Yosef has it down to a T. He's got it down to the day, and he's got it all figured out. He probably, I don't know if he knew that how it was going to happen with the brothers and Binyamin. But the fact that the purpose of the famine is to bring about that which Hashem already had told Avraham Avinu in the Bris Bein Avisarim, that your children will be a ger be'eretz lo lahem, that they will be strangers in a land not their own, and they will be slaves. Yosef has it all figured out. He understands this is where we're headed. And that's the purpose of these dreams. That's the purpose of this famine. This is why I am here.
After all, he had a dream as well, didn't he? Right at the beginning, got in trouble.
Yeah, the dreams of
remember that dreams.
But Yosef understands that's why he's here, that's what's going on, this is God's plan, he's got it, he's figured it all out. But he's the only person. No one else has it figured out. The brothers don't even know about it yet. And Paro understands the wealth. Paro sees the material gain, but of course he doesn't understand the implication, the deep implications of what's going on. Yosef sees much further, much broader than everybody else. He's got it figured out. Yeah.
It's amazing that Yosef was not a citizen of Canaan. Anywhere he was, he knew this is going to be the great power. He didn't. I can't explain. In other words, he had a detachment that I'm not.
Right.
I don't settle.
Right.
I just.
Right.
See what Hashem wants.
Right.
He is the controller.
He's above it all.
Yeah. See,
we've said before, Yosef was groomed for this position, which he's about to get put in. Yaakov groomed him for it. Yaakov knew that Yosef was going to be in a position like this. Didn't know how, what, when, but he knew there was going to be something like this. That grooming ultimately caused the jealousy. And we said before that Yosef wasn't ready for the position when he was 17 years old. And on his madrigal, on his level, where he was at, slightly misused that prominence. And that caused the whole issue with the brothers. When he came to Egypt, he was slowly but surely being groomed by Hashem. Every time he was rising the prominence, like you mentioned before, rising the prominence in Potiphar's house, but then, again misusing it, boom, he's back, and now he's a prisoner. Now he rises the prominence in prison. And now he interprets the butler's dreams, but then again misuses it. He asks the butler for help. Boom, he stays another 2 years. Hashem is grooming Yosef as well. Finally, when he's 30 years old, 13 years after the original dreams that he has, that he knows he's going to rise to prominence, now he's ready. He's gone through the training process, and it's been a rough road. Basic training has been pretty rough for Yosef.
That's the Marines.
Right, that's right. But now he's ready. And when he's ready, he's fully ready. Yosef is 100% ready. Yosef, as I said, he sees, he's got the big picture, he's got the vision, and he's got, like you mentioned, the detachment. He's not letting the events control him. He is running the show, which is what Hashem wants. And Yosef is going to now be appointed viceroy, and it's important to note, Yosef becomes viceroy at a tender age, 30 years old is a young age. At 30 years old, he becomes viceroy of Egypt, which, if Egypt becomes the most powerful nation in the world, it means Yosef is the viceroy over the most powerful nation in the world, which means other than Paro, Yosef is in control of the entire known world. Yosef is all-powerful after Paro. And Yosef dies at age 110. Yosef has this position for 80 years. 80 years. Who do we know that rules for 80 years? No one rules for 80 years. That's a huge amount of time to be in control. Yosef's grooming was necessary because Yosef was going to have this position for more than a generation. That's what Yosef was being groomed for.
So Egypt became real powerful, but 80 years of supervision from Yosef.
80 years. It's also, when we'll talk about this further down the line, but later on when the Egyptians renounce Yosef's effect on them after Yosef's death, and they forget about Yosef,
right.
That it's all the more mind-boggling because Yosef had been in control for 80 years. That means no one living in Egypt had any recollection of life without Yosef. There was no such thing. The national life of Egypt was intertwined with Yosef. There was no such thing as life without Yosef. It's like in our day, Russia without communism. The whole, like, for 70 years, you had communism there. It's hard to just turn it over. Oh, no communism. How do you, right? But so for the national life of Egypt to be Yosef for 80 years and then to just pretend he didn't exist, it's very difficult to grasp. Question?
Yeah, I was wondering, why is it that Joseph is allowed to see all this, but not Yaakov?
First of all, Yaakov was in mourning over his son. So Yaakov has no nevuah. He can't have prophecy, because a person who is depressed can't have prophecy.
But why did he let himself get into... trained Yosef to... He knew this is coming.
Right.
So he kind of...
Why Hashem wants it this way? He doesn't want Yaakov to know. He wants it to be through Yosef and have everything happen through Yosef.
Because Isaac knew.
Right. Yitzchak knows that Yosef's alive. At this point, Yitzchak has passed away.
Yeah.
At this point, he passed away. He passed away when Yosef was 29. 1 year before this. So we talked about that before the summer, before we broke for the summer. We talked about how the 2 years in jail were the years that Yitzchak passes away. But the Hashem wants, this is now Yosef's show. The torch has been passed. Just as we showed with Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. There's a point in time where it goes from Avram to Yitzchak, and then from Yitzchak to Yaakov. Now the torch has been passed. It is now Yosef's show. The torch has been passed. Yaakov will still be around, and he will show up. And he, as we said, he'll end the famine. Things are going to happen through Yaakov, but primarily Yosef is running the show now.
What does Yaakov do to be punished like that? Like he suffer?
It's not necessarily... Well, there's two sides here. There's his personal suffering of not having Yosef around. Chazal attribute that to the fact that he did not do Kibbutz Avaim for 22 years when he ran away, which is hard to understand because he was supposed to run away. So it needs explanation. And therefore Yosef is away from him for 22 years. But the other half of that is that there has to be a new generation. There has to be... We find this with all of the patriarchs. That they still have a lot of years left when the torch is passed. Avraham Avinu was still quite... had many years left to his life when all of a sudden the Torah moves to Yitzchak. And Yitzchak, the scene shifts to Yaakov when Yitzchak still has many years left to live. Here as well, Yaakov still has many years left to live, but the scene has shifted to Yosef. The patriarchs are still living. They're still doing all their good things. They're davening. They're learning. They're good people. They're tzaddikim. But where is center stage? Center stage has moved to the next generation.
Didn't we say that the story of Dinah already, the torch kind of...
That was the first point.
Yeah, cook to the side.
That was the first point. There we said it was passing. It was like a dual thing over there. Right? That was what was going on over there. The brothers now have taking matters into their own hands at that point. Right. What is the difference between Navon and Chacham? In Pasuk Lamed Gimel 33. Yosef says to Paro that he should seek out a man who is both Navon v'Chacham. Navon comes from the word Bina, and Chacham is wise. And the way they translate it in English is discerning and wise. So we have different words for wisdom. There's Das, there's Bina, there's Chachma. There's different words. Each one connotes a different thing. Das is knowledge. If you know a lot of facts, you have Das. If you can list all of the state capitals, that's Das. Right? Okay, that's Das. That's knowing facts. That's Das. Bina is being able to take two or three or elements of Das and figure out something else based on the knowledge. Taking that knowledge and figuring out something that you weren't told based on that knowledge. So if you were taught how to add, you were taught 2 plus 2 is 4, and then on your own you figure out that if I take 4 and I subtract 2, I'll get 2. That would be a bina. That would be figuring something out based on what you had been told. I mean, I'm talking to someone who had never learned subtraction and figured it out from addition. Chachma seems to be which is like Chachma HaTorah. Chachma seems to be a wisdom that is beyond the natural. That already goes into knowing things that are beyond our realm.
Like
prophecy would be Chachma, right? But also a Talmud Chacham is someone who knows Torah. Torah is a wisdom which is beyond just the regular wisdom of the world. The Gemara makes it clear that men, as a general rule, are more inclined to Da'as, knowledge, and women, as a general rule, are more inclined to Bina, to figuring things out. Now, the way the Gemara says this, it's interesting to note, is the Gemara says that a woman has a Bina Yesera. Everybody quotes that, Bina Yesera. But do you know where it says it? It doesn't just say Bina Yesera. There's one more word to that statement. It says a woman has a Bina Yesera, but there's one more word. Be Orchid, with guests. That's what it says. With guests.
Psychology.
A guest comes to the house. Yes. A guest comes to the house. Now, the assumption is a guest we don't know very well, right? A guest comes to the house, someone who's out of town, someone who's a newcomer in town, has no place to sleep, no place to eat, and you invite them to your house. A woman figures out that person more quickly and more accurately than the man does. Bina Yesera Be'orchen. That's what the Gemara says.
What is
Yesera? Extra. Yosera.
So you're saying we take it a step further by saying we have more?
I'm just saying that's the quintessential case. And if you're going to, you're going to show an example. But that's the case where the Gemara uses it. Right.
So isn't also the
Lamb Shem
from Abraham
to Sarah?
Does women have it,
Bnei Sarah? Well, it doesn't say Bnei Sarah over there. There it says, Ruach HaKodesh was greater than his. Mm-hmm. That's what it says over there. That would be more Chachma, the Ruach HaKodesh. Now, the truth is that we need to devote more time to this to fully develop it. I have this talk with each of my daughters when they get old enough to follow this, to understand what the Gemara means when it says Nashim Daitan Kalos, that women, their das is kal means light. that their das is kal, but women have a bina yisera ba'orchet. One is meant to offset the other. There's obviously, what the Gemara is telling us is that with das, a man has an advantage over a woman. With bina, a woman has an advantage over a man. The Gemara is also saying something else, that with a man, the two, the das and the bina, are relatively equal. There's an equilibrium there. With a woman, there is a diminishing of das, but an increase of bina. That's what the Gemara is saying. The Gemara doesn't say anything about men, about whether the das, it just says men are men. A woman, compared to a man, the das is lower, the bina is higher. Obviously, this is all generalities. So there are always going to be exceptions. But that's what the Gemara says. So this is, to develop this issue of how to understand that is really needs more time. And maybe not a whole class, but it needs more time. And maybe next time we'll cover that. It's hard to do, especially new people are going to be here next week that weren't here this week. You know, it's going to be hard to do that. But at any rate, that's a whole discussion of itself. What Yosef is saying to Paro over here is you need to find a man who is Navon, who has Bina, V'chacham, and has Chachma. Why doesn't he say Das? What about a man who has Das? Because most men have Das. That's no trick. Finding a man who has Das is no big deal. That's normal. But you got to find a man who also demonstrates Bina and Chachma.
This is perfect.
Well, not perfect, but that you got to find someone who has more than just the typical man who has the das. You're going to find someone who has Chachma and Bina also over here, because you need someone who really is going to do a good job over here to really handle what's going on. You're going to need someone which has much more than the typical situation. You don't need just a wise man. You know, one of your regular wise men. You need something more than that. So that's why he tells him you need an Ishna von Chacham. Paro is going to say later on that there's no one more than of a Navon and Chacham than Yosef. That's what Paro's going to say. Based on Yosef's interpretation of these, there's no one better than Yosef. That's why he's going to appoint Yosef. But that's why he uses the terms over here, Navon and Chacham, because that's accentuating what normally you would not find in men, and he's saying you should find it. Yeah?
How long does the Paro live?
I don't know. I don't know how long Paro lives. Uh-huh. I don't know, because we don't know whether it's a different Paro or the same Paro later on.